Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, just a little content warning here up front. First of all, we're going to be talking about Game of Thrones and the themes that Game of Thrones tends to be associated with. So there's going to be some discussion of portrayals of sexual violence and trauma, as well as some physical violence. And you should also be advised that there's going to be a lot of spoilers in this podcast as well. So if those two things are deal breakers, just know that going in, this is an episode you might want to consider skipping. Hope you enjoy the show. Hi, it's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints,
where
the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, surrender.
Rob, like Daenerys, has taken a sudden turn, and we've had no foundation laid for what just happened here.
You know how it is, you got an entire plan, then you just see the red key, and you just lose your shit, burn it down, and then hold a Nazi rally.
Uh-huh. Filled with people of color, thank you.
Yep. Representation. And entertainment has been inspiring and provoking us lately.
Uh-huh. Fuck.
Gathered around the table, you've already heard him, Austin Walker.
Provoking is right.
And that is the, those peals of laughter are from Patrick Klepek.
Peals, that's a, you know, I don't know how to take that, but I'll accept it. Hello.
And, of course, we have our producer, Kato, working the boards. So, this is not necessarily a Game of Thrones. It is. There's going to be some takey stuff here. But we've basically all been immersed. Even if you did not watch the show, we all have a keen sense of how this last season of HBO's long-running fantasy drama has been received by fans, and it's been all over the map. Austin, one of the things that caught your eye, one of the takes that stood out to you was something from Scientific American, of all places, trying to scientifically explain, why does everyone hate the show now?
Yeah, so this was from Zeynep Tufekci, who is how would I even describe what her field is? Data and cultural analysis and science. She's someone who is like an expert source you could go to if you wanted to write about like Cambridge Analytica or about the way Twitter and culture interact, you know, kind of like online culture. She wrote this fantastic piece for Scientific American that is one of, you know, a couple dozen pieces that have come out over the past 6 weeks as the show has aired, that has tried to hypothesize a reason for the discrepancy in quality, the perceived discrepancy in quality, between earlier Game of Thrones seasons and the current one. A little background for me, I only watched the first couple of seasons of the show and then bowed out until the recent zeitgeist, at which point it was impossible not to want to know what was happening, and I was going to lunch with Kato and Natalie, and they were going to fucking talk about it, so I had to at least know what was happening, so it was like, I better read a recap, watch some scenes, watch a whole episode here or there. And what had been frustrating me for weeks as the as these types of articles were coming out, was that they all fell into like a couple of camps. And it was mostly like, well, the earlier ones were based on the books, which is true, but also not true. It's not like the show has never deviated from the path of the books in George R. R. Martin's storytelling.
And also, just a small side note, like, adapting a thing is not just copying and pasting. No,
right, exactly. That's the other half
I also
of this
hate,
is,
like, Lost in the Lobs is like, hey, whatever you think of those showrunners, and they got lots of problems, but also, like, adapting a book is not just like,
right,
cool, we got this, put a camera in the scene and we just take this dialogue.
We just do it. It's never been the case. It, just like localization is not, is not like pure simple translation, all adaptation is an art, and there is good adaptation, there is unsuccessful adaptation, etc. You know, there were takes that were like, oh, actually it hasn't changed that much at all. And what all of them were missing was analysis of the storytelling itself, or of actual structural, or even just like focused content analyses. About what did change. And so when Tufekci wrote this piece, The Real Reason Fans Hate the Last Season of Game of Thrones, which I am so, I could feel the hands of an editor trying to figure out how the fuck do we sell this story all over that headline, which we'll get to in our second half when we talk about the media empire of Game of Thrones and
the headline's
how it affects.
The headline's not a lie.
It's not a lie.
As the struggle with all headline writing is, yep, is how to, it's not a lie, is your, is
but you can't put sociological, you can't put sociological in a headline and expect people to click it. No. And so what Tufekci ends up laying out is this argument that in the earlier seasons of the show, as it burned through characters, as it moved from new location to new location and gave you great detail on what the local cultures were, what the conflicts were among peoples, and gave you a kind of broad understanding of what the world of Game of Thrones is and how it functions, was a sort of sociological storytelling, and she's contrasting this to the psychological storytelling that is so common in kind of what she kind of frames as like Hollywood storytelling and Hollywood cinema. The big difference here being that sociological storytelling gets at the way structures lead to actions. It's not that there aren't characters. It's not that there isn't interesting characterization. It's that the good and bad decisions are not limited to being caused by the interiority of the characters. It's often the case that you can see how someone who is a villain makes the choices that they make, and not only in the they were scarred as children sense, but in the here are the material forces at work that pushed them to this decision making, and that was compelling world building. That because the Game of Thrones, because the show was not so focused on only Jon Snow from the very beginning, because it was willing to move through the Starks and move across continents and move the camera from person to person in the same way that something like The Wire was willing to do as it moved from industry to industry, it was able to compel the viewer into investing into the world in this way that not many other types of shows did. And then in the last two seasons, not so much. Mostly this move towards, in an effort to wrap things up, focusing in on characters and psychology and psychological storytelling. And it was just a very useful piece for me as someone who thinks about storytelling in this way. And to be clear, I don't think that she's saying that psychological storytelling is a quote-unquote bad thing, but that in the absence of the sociological turn, in the absence of focusing on that sort of the mechanics of society and the mechanisms of choice-making that go on behind the scenes, the show ended up falling into the traps and the tropes of more generic fantasy storytelling. I'm curious for both of you if that like added up with your experience as people who maybe watch more of the show than I have.
Yes and no. I think there's an element to this that what Tufekci is describing to a degree is something I would maybe more call a form of realism, I suppose. It covers the same ground, but I think in terms of the way I always sort of conceived of Game of Thrones is this idea, it is absolutely critiquing a lot of structures that we tend to romanticize, right? This is one of the major early arcs around Sansa Stark, mm-hmm, where she is sort of the reader insert for someone who naively idolizes the society and the romantic myths of it. And a lot of the early part of her arc is particularly like Sandor Clegane specifically trying to puncture that and say, no, actually, this is all founded on like violence and, power and exploitation. But a lot of what drives action in these stories is this idea that there are these material and institutional constraints acting on all the actors. I guess I would call it that is sociological to a point, but also it is a function of internal consistency in creating a world and then roughly sticking to its rules. What I like that Tufekci does is, you know, she does allow for the fact that even by psychological storytelling standards, Benioff and Weiss also fucked up like by those lights as well, because the characters are it's very CW drama in these last two seasons, right? Like
the fuck are you saying about Riverdale? You keep Archie's name out your mouth.
But it is very Riverdale, right? Mm-hmm. Riverdale is a show that became very self-aware of its gif-ability, of the way it was like shared and experienced as a social event. And that self-awareness you began to see reflected in the show. The difference is, I think Game of Thrones remained really self-serious about it. It doesn't play around with that as much as you know, Riverdale does, because Game of Thrones has this really like serious foundation, and there are certain moments that that show is obligated to try to live up to. But in terms of the way it moved from week to week, and characters just starting it, they stopped being so much characters and became sort of like dolls that like Benioff and Weiss were just sort of moving around in, you know, in the playset and having them do rad shit or like plot twisty stuff,
right?
That's where all of this seemed to break down. But I'm not entirely sure that I would have described the show as sociological necessarily. I think that maybe. I think, you know, sociological, if we're saying like The Wire is kind of the greatest example of something like that, I'm not sure Game of Thrones ever rises to that level.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it did for me, certainly. It's part of why I ended up bouncing off of it, even in its good years. I also just got busy. You know, I'm not here to be like, those early seasons were bad. Like, not at all. But I do think that the thing for me is that I don't think she's saying sociological as a superlative. I mean, she does think sociological storytelling is important, right? The bigger point she's making is that it's useful for us to have stories that work in this kind of, at this layer, the layer of institutions crashing against each other, the layer of, you know, the example she gives is if, yes, a company can have a bad CEO, you know, you can have a terrible CEO at a company, and you can imagine a world in which that CEO is replaced. But what you can't imagine is like a CEO so individually, you know, heroic that the general structure of capitalism changes, right? And that is definitely key in Game of Thrones from the very top, right? That like yes, Joffrey is a particular asshole, a terrible person, was the fucking worst of the worst, but him being removed from play did not upset the fundamental structure. And in fact, one of the big, we should say, there are probably going to be some spoilers for Game of Thrones here before I continue for the final season, because I think to talk about it as a whole work, you probably need to be able to talk about how it leaves off. Like, certainly for me to be able to say that I think it was very reactionary in its final moments, you have to be able to talk about that. And the final, you know, so spoilers ahead for the rest of the show. Giving it a beat. Okay. So I think that even in the end, when you have them fundamentally remaking what the structure of the kingdom is, but only a little bit, it is still echoing that notion of sociological storytelling. It is not one person stands up and says, "What about democracy?" And everyone goes, "Yes, that hero understood." It does still at least imagine a world in which, like, the weight and momentum of history is a limiting factor on what people can imagine the recreation of the world. I don't love that scene in general. I think that scene is literally putting all of your favorite dolls together and being like, now decide the future. But I do think that like that's what she's talking about. It's not just like this is good. It's good for us in this historical moment to be able to think about the world in this way and to have stories help us think about the world in this way. But it is not like all sociological storytelling is good. You can have bad sociological storytelling. You know, I think that is a possibility that you can have lots of stories that just get overly complex with, I'm guilty of telling some of these, with too many institutions where you can't really unpack what it's trying to say thematically. And it's just not entertaining when you have, you know, too much of a focus up at that layer. There are times that you can fuck that up. But I don't think that Game of Thrones early on did that either. I think that it was trying to blend those two things pretty well. Patrick, I'm curious for you.
Part of what I found useful about the piece was the way it posits the mass attraction of Game of Thrones through, like, it provides a term to explain a huge part of the attractions that we don't have stories that are told in this fashion, right? It's normally characters push on world, not world push on characters, to like be reductive of like describing like often like the shifts that happen in Game of Thrones. And like when people say, like, you know, when you talk about things that people talk about, like issues, my own personal issues with like the later seasons, like when characters adopt plot armor, right? Like when they are suddenly able to escape certain death, like that is an instance of the game of the show violating certain ideas that it's set up of, no, like the world will push on these characters instead of the other way around. And part of the frustration over character surviving moments like that is because part of the attraction to the show in the first place was that subversion of what you expect to happen with characters, where you do fall in love with the world itself or the world's rules or lack of rules compared to our traditional understanding of like how stories are supposed to be told and the arcs of characters. And so I found that the essay just like useful in, there are lots of reasons why people fell in love with the show. Like it had terrific casting. It was an incredible show to look at. A lot of that stuff adds up to some of its parts, but when people say like, it was so amazing how people could just die and it goes on. So, well, the reason that even works is because of the way the show sets itself up with its institutions, but you just don't, the average person isn't really thinking about that stuff. But because that's the way the game operates within the show, it ends up working. Even if you don't realize, that's why you're enjoying what you're watching.
I think when I'm considering really successful dramas that have pulled this off, what's the way to put this? I think a lot of dramas have done a fantastic job of telling stories in this way that at least superficially seem like they're more about characters than they are about like institutions and structures, right?
Yeah.
I think like The Sopranos is a decent example of it, right? Like The Sopranos, people talk about through the lens of primary characters, but really what that show is really about is a lot of broader themes. I think that's true of a lot of dramas. I compare this to a show that I think really highly of is Justified. And Justified kind of, it did stick the landing despite a rough next to last season. But when I think about Justified, I think one of the very clever things it did was that superficially it was selling you on this idea of like Raylan Givens, this gunslinging U.S. Marshal, was this very sort of cowboy hero going into the backcountry of Kentucky and clashing with, a charismatic, gangster played by Walton Goggins. But over the course of that series, what they do a very good job of doing is having these characters explore that world and through their experiences build up a sense of the place and the constraints these characters labor under, including the ones they carry around inside themselves, right? The ways these structures, institutions, and limitations and prejudices have shaped the individual characters, and then seeing that reflected back out through individual action. I think one of the things that, and this is probably the essay I really do agree with, is that in sort of kicking away the structural underpinnings, Game of Thrones didn't replace it with a sense of how to show these twists and turns, how to depict motivation of characters, how to convincingly portray evolving thought, evolving feelings, evolving ambitions. And I think that is the other part of this. And this is where I do think people who say that losing the support, losing the underpinnings of the novels really hurt the show, is that as long as you kept referring back to this text that constantly, almost to a fault, returned to this like broader context and all the various constraints and institutions that existed in this world. You can only go so far astray, but once they were completely devoid of that, they kind of did reveal that they needed that kind of storytelling because they didn't understand the psychological and internal storytelling that would be required to bring a show like this in for a landing.
Yeah, I think that that's pretty accurate. And I think part of that too is, so I think part of the thing I want to make sure that we get at here as we talk about this stuff is that I don't think Tufekci nor we are saying that what she calls psychological storytelling is like innately inferior or an altogether separate category, right? She talks about the strong early season psychological storytelling that happens alongside the sociological stuff. And for me, I think about two kind of golden age of television shows, both of which were canceled before they were due, Carnival and Deadwood. And so Tufekci says that here we go. I'm just going to read this one section as she describes this. The tension between internal stories and desires, psychology and external pressures, institutions, norms, and events was exactly what Game of Thrones showed us for many of its characters, creating rich tapestries of psychology, but also behavior that was neither saintly nor fully evil at any one point. It was something more than that. You could understand why even the characters undertaking evil acts were doing what they did, how their good intentions got subverted, and how incentives structured behavior. The complexity made it richer than a simplistic morality tale where unadulterated good fights with evil. And I think that that's true for both. I think that that's true for both Deadwood and Carnival. But I think only Deadwood is doing sociological storytelling, right? I think so. For people who don't know, Deadwood is about Deadwood. Is it North Dakota? Which one of the Dakotas is it? Is it one of the Dakotas? Am I misremembering?
No, because it's unincorporated. They're basically squatting on indigenous land at the start. Yeah. I can't remember what it
is now. South Dakota. And is kind of a Western set in a frontier town that is deeply interested in the coming together of kind of the arrival of coastal powers with the, at that point, still quote unquote lawless lands of the West, the arrival of, we were just talking about Justified, a U.S. Marshal played by Timothy Oliphant, and the ways in which the local powers that be, both official and unofficial, come together to effectively build society, build you know, a new town in the wild, quote unquote. And I think that so much of what works about Deadwood is about the ways in which those pressures lead characters to make choices. Carnival is a kind of supernatural story told set in the 1930s in the Dust Bowl at the height of the Depression that, you know, is, if you've played the Assassin's Creed games, there's a lot of like ancient fight between good and evil. There's a lot of like mysterious texts that are revealing deep connections between characters. It's a fantastic show, but actions are about who these characters are internally. It's about why they're driven to do what they do and how they relate to each other, about like just about their psychologies, just about what they think is good, what they think is bad. And they're plopped into situations that pull stuff out of them. But you're not really thinking about what the structure of the world is as you watch that show. And I think that like part of the thing that ended up happening, or from what I can tell with Game of Thrones, is that it didn't commit early on to either one of those things. It did both of them pretty well, but it did both of them in a way that kind of latticed together. I don't think this show works without the character work done by these actors. I don't think it works without giving, you know, people like Tyrion the space to really bring you into the interiority of that character. Even with like the little bit that I've seen, even though, you know, three seasons or whatever that I've seen, I think that that is true. But I think that he only makes sense when he's giving speeches about what it means to be a dwarf in this society. And his decisions are all latticed up over what those pressures are. And so when you remove one of those two foundations, it just kind of struggles and it doesn't quite, I mean, it goes back to what Patrick was saying. They feel like dolls being placed in positions, not like with plot armor, because that's where they're ordained to be, instead of feeling like people in the world, you know? it's weird. It was very strange to watch them struggle with this season.
Yeah, and especially because we'll talk about this maybe later in another context, but it was troubling the degree to which when they were at a loss for what should happen next, what their actual narrative instincts were, right? Like once they were kind of unmoored from the underpinnings of the novel and they basically discard the kind of realism or consistency that a lot of that framework had forced upon them. And they just fully lean into the, well, look, anybody can be at any place, anytime, and anybody can do a heel turn at any moment. Then what they chose to do and what they chose to portray and how they went about doing it, I think that's the other part of why this left such a bad taste in your mouth, because it begins, like in a lot of ways, Game of Thrones begins as a very critical work and maybe even a subversive one. Subversive tends to get overused a lot, but in terms of like what it is saying about the fantasy genre and also the way like that informs a lot of our imagination and our aspiration and our expectations for politics and what is possible, Game of Thrones began as a very critical work, to say the least, and by the end it was, you know, to your point at the start of the segment, Austin, a worryingly reactionary one. And a reactionary in also like those very traditionalist ways that were really concerning. Like, this is a show that had always had missteps with representing, you know, marginalized people, that had always mishandled things like, you know, sexual violence, you know, gender dynamics. But boy, in the last like two seasons, they're sort of just instinctive way of going about these things became even more concerning. And you toward the end, it increasingly became, what show am I watching? What story do you think you're telling? Because I'm not sure it's the one that that I was reading in these novels and watching at the start of the series.
It used to feel like it was very indifferent to the audience, which was the attraction, I think, as an audience member, was that, oh, this story doesn't give a shit about me and what I want. And then increasingly as it went on and the separation with books, and I, you know, I tried reading those books, like the language put me to sleep. Deep respect for the story, but just like could not get into reading Martin's prose. But like, you know, part of the attraction of the series was it on some level seeming to translate some of that to a wider audience, to someone like myself that like could respond to the themes and the characters and the arcs without necessarily the challenge of the way it was actually phrased in the book. And what happens post, you know, when they essentially pivot to the outlines provided by Martin as opposed to the prose provided by Martin, is instead of their eyes being on the book and adapting that, it's their eyes to the audience and adapting their expectations. And you see that in, you know, Martin put out a blog post this week largely confirming suspicions that, like, it's not, like, don't like kid yourselves. Like, this is mostly where it's going. It's just the journey there might be a little more nuanced and different, and the pieces in different places, but that like most of the pieces will be in similar spots, even if the way you arrive there is potentially or theoretically more satisfying. But it does feel like the moment the audience like turned their eyes towards the showrunners, that they buckled in a number of ways where they just really weren't prepared. Like the written word for them acted as guardrails, like you put it, Rob, and like the lack of those guardrails. I mean, on some hands, I'm like deeply sympathetic because, like, I mean, there's all sorts of things that would excuse about what they did, and especially the way they like, you know, have Sansa rationalize being experiencing all sorts of sexual violence is what made her like a strong person. Like, that shit's fucked up and is unforgivable. At the same time, it's like Jesus, like they started the show thinking like, no way, these books will be done, we're good, like we start this project thinking we've got these guardrails from start to finish, and then suddenly you don't. And it's like weird to think how it maybe paralyzed like both sides, like your story leaving the station paralyzes Martin, the story leaving the station paralyzes the showrunners, and it like makes for a very messy ending in the process.
Do you think, I have two things here, the first is a question for you, I think a lot about, do you remember Zynga? Yeah. The mobile game company, or the Facebook game company, rather.
I'm pretty sure they're still around.
They're still around. Did you ever read that thing that happened when they tried to make Farmville 2? The specific thing, the reason when they were doing like a follow-up to Farmville, one of the things that they said in public was that their initial group of players from Farmville learned what a good video game was. and they learned it by playing Farmville. Playing Farmville, they were like, here is what I like about a video game. Here is what I don't like. Here's the design ethos that speaks to me. And Farmville 1 failed. I may be misremembering some details, to be clear, so please don't write it and tell me that this was not Farmville 2. It was something else. I promise I know I could be fucking this up. The point is, they basically taught their players what a good game was, and then could not keep up with their own expectations. So I'm curious, to some degree, is this like five or six good seasons of Game of Thrones, where the audience is becoming in having their expectations raised and raised and raised, not only in the like more spectacle, more blood, more violence, more, you know, whatever, more sex and food porn, etc., but also in terms of, like, I demand greater character drama. I demand, you know, a better understanding of why characters are doing this. I demand longer scenes, longer seasons, more time before every big pivotal decision. And they, like, tested out of the final two seasons, which, you know, in our, you know, very, we talk about this in multiple choice kind of game design, or in branching path game design, the diamond that brings everything back together. But that's also true in a lot of traditional linear storytelling, even when there are not branching paths, where narrative threads need to come together and become a little more focused. Do you think that there was a world in which you as a viewer were just like, pile it fucking on, I need more of what you're giving me now? Is that what that experience was like? Or is that unfair?
I can like theorize a world where like they are able to land the plane a little better with like twice as many episodes, maybe a couple more seasons. But again, you know, you go back to moments like they're misunderstanding,
right?
Not even misunderstanding is the right word, but like the way they handle characters like Sansa, and it's like, well, on some level, you just don't get these characters, or your understanding of them is so different than the journey they have gone through that it doesn't. You may have, like, by expanding the timeline, it would have, like, by virtue of time, given a better acclimation to where it goes. But on some level, it feels like they graduate, like, the moment the split happens with the text, they've graduated out of their lane, right? Like, this is actually, you know, like, this is, I think, like, the phrasing of lane is used in the original essay of, like, both in terms of a structure of how these two stories split into two sort of like structural acts is different. There's also like, as a writer, like I think about what is my own lane? Like, what am I good at? And I try to stick to that because I know what I'm good at. I know what my strengths are. And you like to like branch out and try different things. But also there are realizations that like some things aren't you. And like, those aren't necessarily things you should tee up and try and hit home runs on. And it increasingly feels like it was more that like the second run of that show should have been, at the very least, the writers recognizing maybe we aren't the, you know, the ones to handle this. Like, you know, even this like particular season, the episode before the big fight, it's the I forget what the Winterfell episode is called, but it's the talkie episode at Winterfell, you know, which I actually think is one of my favorite episodes in the whole series. But is one that is, I don't know how much of that is like recency bias, because it stands out so relative to a lot of other like lower rung episodes that surround it. But
also,
it is
smart
one,
to just put the Citadel DLC in the final game.
Bioware structure.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, it's taking advantage of like, you know, having all these characters and just like nothing happens, but everything happens. But like the reason that the episode was so satisfying was because. One, it's written by like one of the better writers on the show that seems to like understand the characters. It wasn't written by the showrunners. But it got back, you know, it like harkens back to like what you fell in love with. It's like, oh, this actually was a show about talking before it was a show about like people dying, or the dying was incidental to the talking. And I don't know. I think they graduated out of their lane, but then you become powerful and it's quote unquote your story.
Right.
And and maybe they just weren't the ones that should have finished it.
I think there's an element of that. And Kato, by the way, mentions that episode was called A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms because it does build and hinge on someone being knighted.
God, that is such a DLC name also. It really would be. The DLC would be called that 100%.
But I think something else that happened along the way here, and I think this was a thing that surprised a lot of people, is that I think in the books, but certainly throughout the show as well, there are a lot of inconsistencies of character, or like a mixture of like showing the good, how the good can be mixed with the bad. And I think something weird that happens in these final two seasons is it increasingly becomes preoccupied with this notion of who is going to win the Game of Thrones. Like that becomes the central drama of the final run of seasons here. And the weird thing is, if you like the early part of the show, certainly the books, like that's not the point. It really isn't. Like by book four, you're kind of just praying for this to end in some ways. Not in the like I'm sick of this story, but like what is being portrayed is so unrelentingly nightmarish and bleak that you are just starting to think like this can't go on. This is like a civilization destroying event, and the harm that is being inflicted is just staggering. The entire point, right, is that to people at the highest levels of this power, this is a game. This is a contest for control, for influence, and to everyone else, this is a catastrophe. This is a tragedy. And in these last couple seasons, it becomes increasingly interested in this idea of, okay, but what's the final score going to be after overtime?
Right.
And that's a different answer than the question the show was originally posing. And I think this is the other thing that sort of throws us off at the end. This is why increasingly we see these sudden twists of character, these sudden like flipping of alliances and allegiances, because it becomes about having everything converge on an answer to who's going to win, who's going to be on the throne at the end of all this. And it loses track of the fact that basically the story that's been told prior to this and that had been set up in, you know, in a lot of the earlier seasons and a lot of the earlier books is that the actual question is, how do we escape this cycle, right? How do we escape these institutions, these motivations that generate like recurring tragedies like this? And Game of Thrones, by the end, is this close to being like, so are you Team Danny or Team
it's not,
John?
It's not that close to. Like, did you see the Elizabeth Warren and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Yeah, a video that went up today about how they had to switch from Team Danny to Team Sansa.
Like, so, I mean, some of the market, you know, like the stuff I'd see at airports recently where like Xfinity was like, talking to your remote and you'd say like vote for the throne and then like a graphic comes up and you pick and it's like the moment the advertising is reflecting the narrative in that way, it's probably telling you something about the way you framed the narrative.
Right. I mean, like, look, it's Martin.
It's also natural to go into those camps, right? Like, I mean, like, it's a world of factions. And so that,
right,
that
but
makes sense to some degree, but I think it is reflective of like their own failings narratively, that people then find themselves falling into those sorts of factional camps.
Right. Well, like the first book was called Game of Thrones, but the series in the books is A Song of Ice and Fire, right? Like, and you can so clearly imagine the conference room meeting that's like, well, we can't call it A Song of Ice and Fire. Game of Thrones. Yeah, that we can fucking sell. Who's going to end up on the throne? And like, not that the story doesn't have that element in it already, but you're right that it just becomes entirely preoccupied by that at the end there, which is, I think,
it's
part
like
of
if The Wire built to Kerketti getting elected.
Right, right. Well, like the thing that the Wire did smartly was, and that I think the finale of Game of Thrones gestures at, but does not deliver because it ends the show, is that life goes on, right? Like the Carcetti election ends, and the next scene is the you have to eat a bowl of shit scene, right? That like things keep coming. The world doesn't end when this happens, and instead with Game of Thrones, what we get is like, I don't know, Arya is going to find a new place to bring white people to, and.
Look, man, no one, they just never gone west. No one even just thought about it.
Yeah,
just
one's ever gone west before. Yeah, maybe the other half of this is actually, maybe there's a corrective here to Fetchy's argument, which is yes, sociological versus psychological storytelling. But what if they actually are still doing sociological storytelling? And the reason we don't like it is their sociology is bad. Because that's how you get Sansa saying that the reason she's so strong is because she's lived through sexual assault. That's how you get the depiction of Dany's revolutionary army as being like terrifying and other and stomping around and like shot in such visual ways that are like historically coded along the lines of like depicting savage black and brown armies. And also the ways in which like Grey Worm's final act to like go try to help the people of Noth is framed as being like unimportant and even like further, you know, there's just no getting through to him. He's just never going to be part of
our
society.
Just brush him off.
Just,
okay. Yeah. Come on, let's we got to go see where John's going.
He doesn't get to be in the final montage. Starks only, baby. It's wild that like actually all of these characters actually, maybe not all of them. I think Tyrion's final shit is just like all this season is just the most, can we make a character make the worst decisions again and again for no reason, despite being the smartest person in the room. But many of them do point to kind of institutional pressures or reasons to why they're doing what they're doing. It's just that I don't know that the showrunners have a good idea of how those institutions actually do work. Or again, specifically, I think that like,
but isn't that maybe illustrative of like some earlier points of like,
yeah,
adaptation is an art.
Yes.
You don't necessarily need to fully grasp I've never adapted a book, but I talking to friends who are like screenwriters, like it seems like it's possible to adapt a work without necessarily internalizing everything about like what the, you know, what makes every part of it tick. Right.
Totally.
So it's like not hard for me to imagine like these showrunners having been, like Dunning for the most part, like by and large, like a pretty great work of like merging characters, cutting a lot of fat from like some really long books and like finding a way to like mainstream a lot of like really difficult concepts, ideas, a strange world and making it the most popular television show of all time. Like that's a pretty difficult feat. And then when suddenly tasked with, well, no, you have to do the DLC. Like there's some broad, you know, some broad strokes, like you got to get to here, but you know, there's like 40 hours
right.
You got to fill from there. And that's just like that's a fundamentally different ask in a way that may reveal like how little you grasped what you were adapting because
right.
those are different things.
It's already hard to just write. Like I don't know if you've written fiction before, but you've written journalism before. You've written big feature stories. How many times when you've written a big feature story have you finished it, looked back at it, looked at your notes, and gone, this is not the thing that I thought I was going to write? Like, maybe the basic points are there, but wow, like, this is actually, like, really not as funny as I thought it would be. Or like, you know what? The character disappeared in the middle of this thing and I just got caught up by listing facts and I didn't actually stick to the character who was interesting. Like, writing is already very hard. So the idea of both needing to do that and adapt it and then to lose that first step is, yeah, I'm with you. I think it's probably really hard to do that sort of work. And I'm sympathetic in that way. But I'm also frustrated that like, you have the most popular show in America, in the world, maybe. I don't know if there's a more popular show in bigger markets. There probably is. But in America, at least, where you have a character who is – and this is not a defense of Dany because I think Dany is also someone who has historically – in the rest of the show been like positioned as a white savior, has like, I cannot talk about how frustrating it was in 2016 to see like hurrah, Hillary Clinton stands sharing pictures of Hillary Clinton with dragons, and like, you know, underneath literally people being like, yo, this is the woman who was like positioned as a white savior for season after season after season. I mean,
there's a season where the final shot is Danny surrounded by brown people as like soaring violins play, and she's lifted up.
And Danny's a character
and the show's not being critical of that. No. It's saying like, you should be excited about this.
Breaker of chains. But the thing that's frustrating,
that seems like a misreading. Maybe both of you can like illustrate this better as, you know, having more familiarity with the books. But like, I get the impression that the book would be implying a little more of like a wink wink about like how you should be feeling about this scene more so than the show is portraying that.
The books have some issues, my guy.
the books do have issues. I think an interesting thing to note here is that how quickly do these groups of like liberated armed people of color morph from being like people like that you identify as people like who are suffering and who need aid in achieving their liberation. How quickly that show flips from that to them being just pure instruments of someone else's will and then a threat. And that is a move I'm just not sure I would have seen. I'm not as sure the books would have screwed up as much, because the books do, again, almost to a fault, do a better job of laying out more motivation, creating more characters to explain like the perspectives of different groups within its world. Whereas here it very much begins to feel like it's Khaleesi and Friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think basically guarantees that imagery, which was already troubling enough, becomes almost unredeemable.
Yeah. Well, and it gets to my most, the most frustrating point for this finale for me is the moment where, John kills Danny, and it's not because of the killing. It's not because the Drogon, the dragon, decides to burn the Iron Throne, which is maybe the only prediction I've ever made that's come true in this show. It's so fucking funny when it happens. It's that her final scene is her being presented as naive as to the decisions she's made, with one or two tells that maybe she is indifferent to people, but she's not being strategic. She's the Mad Queen, right? Which is a whole bucket of problems that we can get into around representation.
Yeah, I don't want to get in there.
The whole
pitch of the finale being like, well, actually, it's just the blood that's in your veins.
It's just the blood in your veins determines blah, blah, blah. Right, totally. Absolutely. Doesn't fuck John over somehow, but anyway. I mean, 50-50, right? It's a flip of the gods flip a coin. Whatever. People in that world might believe that. It might not yet. You know what the fuck I mean. So the thing that I actually want to focus on is like what there was an opportunity for there is the reveal. Instead of the reveal that she is childlike in her view of the world and her quote-unquote destiny, is a leader who does have revolutionary goals and who, you know, maybe is driven to make decisions that are appalling, but that has a strategy for why she does that thing. It was very funny to see people make these arguments on Twitter. God, who the fuck was it? It was I don't remember if it was... It wasn't Jamel Bowie. It was like someone from the political pundit class. It might have been Jeet, actually. Jeet Air, is that his name? Is that who I'm thinking of?
Yes.
Who made this argument. But that like, oh, here is why she has to kill all of these people after they surrender, because if she doesn't, it sets a certain precedent that other kingdoms who rebel, you know, will be safe if they just surrender when the dragon shows up and blah, 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 blah. And I don't necessarily agree. I don't agree with that, but I would have loved the version of this story that ended with her saying, I am capable as a leader and I'm knowledgeable about the damage I caused, and here is what my reasoning is, and presented a fully fleshed out argument for why she makes the turn she does. And obviously, ideally, would have had that turn not just telegraphed, but developed over episode after episode after episode, where in the end, instead of being just kind of like this child who has gone mad, you have a character who has a fundamentally distinct worldview that Jon Snow has to actually deal with and actually has to confront and cannot wave away as like, you're right, she did go mad. Because the revolutionary worldview that, that her people have is incompatible with the reformist worldview that the Seven Kingdoms have. And those two don't actually ever come into conflict. They decide, you know what, we're just going to go over here and go to Nath, whatever, and deal with what's going on over there, and not actually have to confront the fact that all of the people in the Seven Kingdoms will never, like, remake anything on their own will. They will never break the cycle. In fact, they have just created a new different cycle. And the show doesn't even want to, like, frame it in that way. The show does want to frame, like, wow, Tyrion kind of did end up on the throne in the end. Sure, the throne is now the hand, the chair of the hand, instead of the Iron Throne. But, you know, like...
And don't worry, it's fine that we just put this computer AI in charge of, like, the whole kingdom. Like, how could anything go wrong with a person who can see the future and can manipulate everything to... What
and
future?
yet couldn't have altered it to be less nightmarish.
Right. Until he chose to.
Yeah.
Right?
That's been one of like the theory crafting things going around at the end is like, I choose to enjoy the theory that actually a parasite has just manipulated itself into becoming the king.
I'm glad that indoctrination theory is alive ending. And well and just in all just everything in its right place. I hear that if you keep playing for 70 hours, Kojima comes onto the disc himself and says, now you've unlocked the real ending. Now time for the real Game of Thrones. I could not help thinking that there's a sequel coming. Like that so felt like a setup for a sequel and not for a conclusion.
There's a lot of websites that need one.
Well,
that's the other part of this sort of Game of Thrones doubleheader. Before we go to our break, we should talk about the fact that Game of Thrones basically like...
This is a big conversation, Rob. Rob, we should go to a break and come back and do this because I know you want to sneak this in, but Patrick is grinning. Patrick is ready to talk about media with a capital M.
All right. Then we will take a break and then we will get... Then we will discuss what's going to happen to all of us once the Game of Thrones traffic hose is turned off at the source.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Patrick, you seem like a pretty savvy guy.
Wow.
You've managed to stay afloat in this turbulent media ecosystem, hopping from hopping
ribbit.
From one sinking vessel to the next.
Have you figured out what's next yet, Patrick?
If I did, I wouldn't be telling you.
You should tell me though next time. Okay. Will the next place have Game of Thrones traffic to sustain itself?
We gotta give it like 18 months for the prequel.
Okay.
There was a piece from Splinter, right?
Yes.
That you had linked us to.
Jack Crosby.
Right. So if people who don't know, Splinter is the kind of politics site from Gizmodo Media Group, but it's also kind of just like it is the politics site, but also it's Gawker too in some ways, you know. It's like
yes.
It is quickly becoming one of my favorite things on that network. On the
they have a lot of really good sharp writers that are that weigh in on a variety of topics, including Game of Thrones. Yeah, yes. And Jack Crosby writes a piece called "What Time Does the Game of Thrones Traffic End?" Although
yes,
you can,
I'm so glad you noticed this. Go ahead.
Okay, this is not new, but so like the original headline that gets written for a piece when it gets put into a database is often like hard locked into a cache somewhere, whether it's like the headline that like Google will pull up or it's in like the what they call the slug, which is like when you see in this case like splinternews.com/word-word-word, which makes the head. Sometimes the original headline sticks in there because you're the underlying technology isn't equipped to change it, or once it's out there in the world, Google does its pass. You want to stick with that original pass. And so this piece that Jack wrote that eventually got the headline, "What Time Does the Game of Thrones Traffic End?" I only noticed this like right before recording this, Austin.
Yeah.
But it's my Chrome brings it up as "Game of Thrones Traffic Ending, comma, explained." Yes. Which is also a very funny Voxy
they're so funny. But headline. Even "What Time Does the Game of Thrones Traffic End" is like a parody of SEO focused yes. headlines where you just
when is the Super Bowl on?
is if you want some traffic right now, you should publish a story that's "When is the Super Bowl 2020? Because it will over the next 8 months or whatever, slowly build up that traffic. It's going to be less than 8 months. Holy shit,
just
it's already May.
Just do a search for any, like, just think of any sports event coming up.
Right.
Even just a random baseball game. There are hundreds that take place over the course of a week. There will be a page set up on a number of a sports site that is just like, here's the ABC link.
In fact, someone today pointed out, I think it was Kyle Orland, that if you search when does the PlayStation 5 come out, Google will tell you November 2020 because a site that was like PS5PlayStation5.com in 2014 published a story speculating that November 2020 would be when the PS5 came out.
You know what? I mean,
you know what?
The three-eyed raven was right. That's probably will end up happening. So Jack writes this like really short piece. It's not like a grand analysis of the proliferation of Game of Thrones traffic across websites. But have you been to any place? You've been to IGN? I mean, this is like
Vice.com.
Anywhere, like literally any media site. This is not just something that's specific to video game websites, no. As folks like Jim Sterling might want to reductively use to get likes on Twitter. Game of Thrones. I generally like Jim's work, but come on,
got him.
You know,
shots.
A lot of people have been writing about Game of Thrones because it's easy traffic. A lot of people have been writing about Game of Thrones because they like Game of Thrones, and Game of Thrones is fun to talk about. It is has a lot of vectors in. So it's like, if you're interested in politics, like Game of Thrones has a lot to chew on there. If you're interested in characters, if you're interested in drama, if you're interested in spectacle, like, there's just a whole lot that's happening in that show, and people click on it. And so it has, especially this season, but definitely starting a couple of seasons in, became like one of those reliable things that a lot of places were writing about. This is true of also all of the Marvel films.
Yeah.
Like, you will constantly see MCU-based content, like, everywhere, which is a mixture of writers also having interest in that and it being proven traffic, where if you publish that, as Jack points out, what you're hoping for is like either you have like a take that goes viral, which is a one in a million shot. You just don't know how that's going to go. Or you get not quite one in a million, maybe one in a thousand, where like Google News or Facebook or Apple News or Pocket or whoever picks your piece out of the ether, dumps it in to be the one that gets promoted. And that just sends tons of traffic. And it's just easy. There are very few things in media where it's guaranteed clicks. And Game of Thrones has been one of those things. Marvel is another one of those. And so, you know, this piece from Jack basically kind of walks through how this worked at Splinter and, like, is, I think, interesting in thinking about media at large. But I kind of got set off from this because of Jim's tweet, because I should just bring it up.
Yeah.
So Jim wrote a couple days back, now Game of Thrones is over, what will video game websites do for content? And he's not the first one to point something that's out. I think even Kyle Orland, who we mentioned earlier, not too long ago, posted a photo of the entire front page of Polygon having more or less all Game of Thrones content, which he quickly tried to walk back as just being an observation about games media when it felt more in line with Jim and being sort of a pot shot at a website doing what all websites have to do in 2019, which is that you look for the crossover between audiences, you try and find what people are willing and interested in clicking on, and you do that without hopefully selling your soul in the process and maybe finding it to be in line with the values of the website that you are running and contributing to. And so I don't know what happens after this is all over, except that there will be something else. Because I think there is a desire for water cooler stuff, and something else will kind of fill that void. But Game of Thrones was a particularly zeitgeisty version of that.
Well, I think one of the things that is most interesting here, speaking of sociological storytelling, is that, you know, Crosby gets at the fact that so much of this comes from fear, or like, you know, a desire to talk about it. You know, he's clear that, like, oh, hey, people, it's fun to talk about Game of Thrones. It's fun to do, you know, a take a couple days after an episode goes up. But, you know, the 2,000-word episode summaries, recaps that go up, that people write while the episode is airing so that they can be the first to press, so that they can get that SEO, so the traffic comes their way, much less fun, but reliable. And in an era where there
it's
are...
It's like going to E3 for us.
Yeah, totally. In an era where there are layoffs every couple of months in the industry we're in, when good writers and good reporters lose their jobs, not because they are failing to hit their goals, but just because the company has decided to go in a different direction, being able to point to something that is like sturdy gives you a little bit more insurance, right? Because even if they will fire you, despite the fact that you hit your goals, hitting your goals is still super necessary. And in an era where like the algorithm could change overnight, and the strategy we had on Facebook 2 days ago no longer works because suddenly using colons in the headline makes it illegal to share it or whatever bullshit happens next. Having some sort of source there that it can be a foundation or can be something you can count on is like, it's very easy to start relying on that. And I don't know that that's like capital G good for us, but I do get why it happens.
It might not be good, but it's true, right?
Right,
so like when I saw like a recent era thread building on Jim's tweet, like I was also bothered because the implication from Jim's tweet, or like a general sort of like mocking attitude towards sites to do this. Now, granted, it all runs a spectrum, right? Like there can be, you know, I think clickbait is a word that is thrown out like too casually. But certainly there can be work that is merely meant to trick and obfuscate so that you click on something. Writing about Game of Thrones is not clickbait. Like people are clicking on it because they're interested in Game of Thrones. And
right,
there's a fundamental difference between the two of those things. And so mocking a place like Polygon, which like, one, you're just ignoring like the shift towards general entertainment that site and many others have done over the last 5 years. And it's not just a Chris Plant or someone else writing about movies that they like. It's hiring entertainment reporters
right
from that field to build that out. There's an underlying like, is the implication like, oh, they're just going for the easy stuff, when if they just wrote about fucking video games, like people click on that shit. Well, no, like the dark truth is, like as someone that sees video game traffic every day and writes that stuff, like there's a reason they're writing about Game of Thrones, because like that's easier to predict that people are going to click on it than writing about any random video game. Right now, there aren't even really that many video games that if you just like said, let's just start, just write about Fortnite, like that's not guaranteed traffic in written form, right? Like they're like, we're like in this specific case, like what Splinter's speaking to, what these like larger criticism, it's really around like the written word and like the take economy and reaction content and like which of those do people want to click on. I will tell you, like a lot of it's not video games, or it's way more risky to write about a video game because there just isn't a guarantee in the way that if you put Game of Thrones attached to it, no matter what you're going to say, there's just a higher level of I want to click and read about it that is not the same for a lot of other things, including a shitload of video games.
And I think it's super frustrating. Did either of you watch the latest Errant Signal video that went up at the beginning of this month?
Mm-mm.
Errant Signal, Chris Franklin, at Camster.
Oh, I think I saw him tweeting about
Twitter.
It. Though.
Yeah, he tweeted about it for a while ahead of his video about it. He was kind of just like musing on the fact that for him as a content creator, so people don't know, he does like video essays about video games over on YouTube. Great essayist.
In long form, right? Like not like two or five minutes.
Long form, but honestly, I think actually shorter than the long than. Well, there are people who make 90-minute video game crit as an editor, like, so badly want to get in there with a scalpel and help people focus their stuff and find a single thesis and argue for it so badly. I understand the desire to be
long form when this stuff started, like 8 years ago. Yes. It is no, he has now been eclipsed in 100%.
100%. Like, you know, his videos are like between 10 and 30 minutes, which absolutely is what you would think of as long form games crit 5 years ago on YouTube. But at this point, in the age of like 80 minute game crit, not so much. Anyway, he did a video called Talking About Tiny Games, in which he kind of digs into this in the games journalism economy, in the games criticism economy, in which he kind of says, like, what is the, how, what are the mechanisms by which people who cover video games are rewarded, and who are the winners and losers in that process? And the winners are games that have a built-in audience. And, you know, he ends up making basically a push, you know, on himself and on us to be champions of small games that we think are great, to, in fact, not be critics in the traditional sense and treat those games as the same as AAA products on a store shelf that come with $50 or $100 or $200 million marketing budgets, that when something like We Know the Devil comes out, it is not like Assassin's Creed. When something like, even something like The Return of the Obra Dinn comes out, with all of the you know, the established rep that that game's creator had.
Or even the game I reviewed today on the site, A Plague Tale Innocence, which is like a game that has trappings of like larger games, in which if that was from an established Ubisoft charging $60, probably would have come down like a lot harsher on its failings, but taken for what it is in context, like really liked it and wanted to recommend it to a lot of people.
Right. And so like that is kind of his push there. And I am so like, We've been at the site, Patrick, you and I, now for just about 3 years. Rob, you've been in this. I mean, we've all been in this industry now for a long fucking time. It doesn't need to be about this site. We know what the traffic looks like when you cover a pet project, when you cover a game that you think is fascinating. We've written about movies and TV shows from time to time here. We used to have Open Thread where we were like, that was explicitly our place to champion things that we thought were cool, but was not necessarily going to be a traffic driver. And like, I cannot begin to communicate to people how rare it is that that stuff, that using the platform to push stuff that we think is cool, actually produces an effect or gets eyeballs on it. And so it can be so demoralizing if you are a quote unquote content creator in 2019 who spends hours writing about something that you love. I can imagine this in television journalism, right? I can imagine being the person who is like, even other big established things, the person who's like, I'm going to write about Barry. I'm going to write a great like essay about Barry. And then gets 7,000 people who read that essay.
Good ass show. You should watch the second season of Barry.
I have not done that yet. I need to. And then that same person a week later shits out 700 words on Game of Thrones and gets minimum 70,000 views or whatever, right? It can be so demoralizing and can create an attitude in an editorial room that needs to be constantly battled against, that why are we ever chasing the little thing? And you can make arguments to yourself about, you know, oh, well, this is about prestige. I want to do a good feature. Or this is about, again, championing the little guy, finding someone who is underrepresented, sharing your platform. And we do our best to do all of those things. But in the world where there is this constant pressure from above to do traffic and to do numbers, it can be hard to find a strategy that is effective at pursuing those things. And I actually think that this is true not just because the traffic numbers, but also because of things like budgets that, like, I've told this story before, but when I was working at Giant Bomb, I was trying to get a freelance program off the ground. And, you know, I had a couple bucks to play with, and I wanted to make sure we worked with writers who were going to write about games that weren't getting written about other places, and writers from marginalized backgrounds and with marginalized identities who did not have access to a platform like Giant Bomb's. And one of the biggest hurdles I came to was not the other people at Giant Bomb coming on board for that. Everyone was excited about it. Was not finding talent. There are more than enough critics who had great things to say and smart things to say. Who could write with me. It was not about finding good pitches. I was overwhelmed by the pitches. It was working at a company where, for them, what a freelancer was or a contract worker was someone who was like, because of CBS, part of like a big, a construction union, or was someone who had years of experience doing video production work, someone who had been, you could point to previous tax returns in the field. But if I wanted to work with someone like Heather Alexandra, right, who is now at Kotaku as a full-time staff member there, who at the time was a YouTube games critic, it was like, well, what does she point to prove she does this for real? And you can't point to her YouTube channel. And those are parts of the ways in which these structures control and limit what voices end up on them. And so what you end up doing is like, well, fuck. Thankfully, in that case, I managed to figure out a way through. But when you only have X dollars to play with, when you know your traffic goals are Y, you end up needing to make those decisions that are not always – that you don't feel good about, where you go, well, do we cover the hot new thing, or do we greenlight this retrospective piece about a game that we think is really interesting but that we know isn't going to get – that no one else cares about. Even if you just take the word traffic out, if you just say, does our audience care about this? And if the answer is no, but you think it's important, you're stuck at this dilemma. You're stuck at this crossroads. And this is the where I'm building to this is why it's valuable sometimes to have the Game of Thrones shit, because you can go, you know what? We're going to run that Game of Thrones story this week. I know that traffic's going to be good. Let's please greenlight the History of the Front Mission series, because I know we don't need that traffic this week. It's okay. Let's commission this piece about how important Dark Souls 2 was to this person. Let's commission this story about how important we know the devil was with, someone who was coming to understand their own gender, right? We can commission those stories because we know that traffic is coming from these other places. And I think the best outlets use the kind of cornerstone traffic, hoses like Game of Thrones to then go do good work elsewhere. What I think I'm worried about is that because we've seen the last few years where even sites that have done that are now moving away from that model. That was the BuzzFeed model for years, was do trash to be able to pay for good reportage. And even they are I don't know if that model actually works anymore. I'm so curious, not what the next Game of Thrones is in terms of what the next thing where you can count on traffic is, but what is the next tool that we as editors and writers and content creators will use to let people do the shit we want to do instead of doing only the thing that is the bottom line, if that makes sense. Do you know what I mean? I want to know what the next tool is that we have in our toolbox to let us tell the stories we want to tell, because we know our basics are fucking covered. And maybe that isn't about Game of Thrones. Maybe that isn't the next TV show. Maybe it's unions. Maybe it's what is it? What is the thing?
Someone stumbles upon a formula and then everyone else goes, all right, yeah, let's run this shit.
We'll run
the
this for a while.
Until,
yeah.
Or even the part of at a certain point at Waypoint when we were we should cover some more of the bigger games more. It was all right, well, how do you compromise on that? You do that with, it's not just a by the numbers review. It's well, let's try and take the critical lens that we apply to all sorts of other things and apply that to the big thing that lots of people are talking about.
Right.
And maybe we can have our cake and eat it too, in which we get to put in the headline X game, but we also get to say, our critical take on it, whether
right.
something we liked or we didn't like. And that was a way where you try and you get the Game of Thrones or whatever in the headline while also not feeling as though you're kind of selling your soul down the river just for the traffic.
Right.
Rob?
He's thinking. Yeah. I can see his thoughts.
Part of it is there's just realities of the entire ad-supported model right now across different media, but particularly acute in web media. that make this stuff really tough. I think also there's a broader ethos in business where there's very little appetite for investment for building up infrastructure and organizations and institutions that can like reliably generate returns. And there's much more of an appetite for the idea that we are going to take a lot of mighty swings. And if one of them knocks it out of the park, then that justifies it. But most people are not going to have that home run or grand slam idea. And so what you end up with is just a business environment across a lot of different industries where you see really strange decisions about resourcing being made in terms of what bets people want to make and what kind of returns they tend to turn their noses up at. So I think there's a lot of things that have to change, and I'm at a point where I know like a lot of this feels like it is out of my hands, right? Like I'm not sitting there. I'm like, there are things I can do. I can skew the odds a little bit. But in terms of changing these dynamics, I'm not really sure what the solution is, because there is likely not another Game of Thrones that is going to like there are popular shows. Game of Thrones was a different type of phenomenon. Our last waypoint is I think sports suffers from this a little bit too. LeBron James did not make the playoffs this year. This has actually been kind of a problem for NBA ratings a little bit. Also, the fact that they were, you know, they've gone up against Game of Thrones during these playoffs a couple times, and people are watching Game of Thrones and they're not watching the NBA playoffs.
I think part of the thing that I keep getting stuck on is that it would be, I think, about something like Patreon or direct-to-consumer stuff, paid newsletters, all that shit. And once you have a following, you could do that. And you could cover what you could cover. And as writers and content creators, we would be able to make our bills. We would be able to pay our rent. You'd be able to make your mortgage, probably, Patrick. But you'd only be talking to the people who you'd already converted and maybe the slow trickle of new people. You wouldn't be leading the charge in the way that, like, theoretically, when you wield all of the influence of a big media company, you can actually shift the culture little bit by little bit by little bit. I think about the moments when – I think about stuff like the labor reporting that's gone on over the last few years by people at Kotaku, by people here at Waypoint. I think about stuff like our coverage of something like our coverage on guns last year as being moments when we tried our best to shift a larger conversation. And I think you're kind of saying like, no, I'm not going to do that once you remove yourself from the kind of big media company shit. Like once you're like, you know what, I'm just gonna write about the shit I want to write about, pay me $5 a month to help me do that. And here I am not calling out the people who do that. That is very appealing. I used to run a Patreon. Maybe I will again sometime in the future. Who knows? But what I think the reason that I think we are willing to work inside of these confines, the reason why we're willing to look for the next Game of Thrones, is because the promise that's being made is you can reach so many more people. You can really help try to shift that conversation. And you can even do it while writing about Game of Thrones, because you can write a piece that brings up questions of sociology, because you can write pieces that make you think about what the history of politics and culture is. And even if it's just to say like, hey, they keep fucking up on the way that they write about sexual assault and rape, you can be that person who is addressing that topic to a wide audience of people who probably would not have clicked on that story if it didn't say Game of Thrones. And so I also, like you, rankle a bit when I see people just call it all clickbait, because I see the writers who are doing the real work and who are using it as either a platform to dig into things that they care about or using it to supplement and provide for those bigger picture ideas that they're pursuing. And, you know, I think it is, I would, which one of you said that it's not good, but it's true.
that was me. And
that was you.
Yeah. And yeah. And it's, I just
channeling
think it's,
a Game of Thrones character, I think, actually.
In the same way that, it's reductive to call, you know, the front page of Polygon all having Game of Thrones clickbait. I think it's reductive to, in the larger media landscape, to reduce that to just, well, it's easy traffic. Because while on some level that is true, that is not necessarily the way it's wielded by critics and people who are using that, like you said, as a springboard to talk about other things. Because to get you to click on something because it says Game of Thrones, but then actually, even the essay we talked about in this Waypoints, right? Like, it's about Game of Thrones, but it's not about Game of Thrones, right? Like, it uses that as like a context to talk about larger ideas of storytelling. If you just told me, like, if the two, all right, the two of you are bad examples because you would read the piece that's just about like the psychological and the sociological, but like I probably wouldn't. But putting that in the ties of Game of Thrones was like really fascinating. It made me totally rethink what was interesting and appealing about that story to not just me, but like my wife and, you know, all of our friends who, they're not online. They don't think about, you know, stuff this way. And they share these articles on Facebook in the way that like gets condemned. But I'm out there. I'm out there at the bars listening to these people talk about this shit all the time. And so, I mean, I think, you know, as critics, we can be reductive as well. But, you know, this particular thing rankled me because I think it's just a misunderstanding of how the economy works. And as you said, Austin, essentially tricks that are used to prop it up at times.
Yeah, I think also we see some of these dynamics outside. Like, this is not just a video games entertainment media reporting issue, right? Like, you see this dynamic in sports as well. Like, this idea that everyone is trying to find just the deepest reserve of, like, mass interest in something, and they will just continue creating content around it. This is the first NBA playoffs in a while where we haven't had a LeBron James-led team competing in the playoffs. That was a ratings concern for the NBA. And apparently, to some extent, that's been borne out. Now, obviously, the ratings are also depressed by the fact that people are watching a lot of Game of Thrones on during the Sunday night games, which has kind of hurt them as well. But it is striking the degree to which, in terms of the way sports media is operating right now, LeBron James is still like one of the top stories. Doesn't matter that his team isn't really doing anything. It is now a reality show happening in sports media. And we saw the latest chapter of that this week when we had Magic Johnson, who we talked about a few weeks back, his epic form of quitting the Lakers, just basically going up to the press that were at the Staples Center and being like, I quit, tell my boss for me, bye. So that was kind of how that ended. Since then, LeBron has revealed that he had no idea that was in the wind. It completely blindsided him. Yesterday, again, you know, Lakers, not a competitive team right now. Doesn't matter. Still the biggest story in the NBA right now, in part because it involves so many, such a major franchise and so many like compelling characters. And one of those characters remains Magic Johnson, who went on ESPN's First Take yesterday. As of time of recording, a couple days ago, by the time you hear this, went on First Take. Met with Stephen A. and talked about why he quit the Lakers. And it was kind of an amazing interview because I have never seen somebody so ruthlessly and relentlessly just bash their former coworkers and former employer, but all while very convincingly presenting themselves as not even that mad. Did either of you catch the excerpts from this interview as Magic sort of laid out why he just bounced?
Casually laid it out, like with no regard for the fact that he was dropping bombs and naming names. Yeah. Uh-huh. It's great. He can only do this because he's super rich, right?
That's part of it. I think there's also just an element of the guy is such a star. And I don't just mean that in terms of like, you know, basketball's had a lot of stars that people don't like, right? Like Kevin Durant, it does not matter what he does on the court, like before or for the rest of his career, for whatever reason, you know, he just doesn't, he's not going to be that easygoing guy that everyone just loves. Like Kevin Durant will never be cool. The way
Go look
Magic
at his Twitter
cool.
feed. He's injured, yeah, and he's just spending it being extremely online.
He is, yeah.
Well, and he had Sock Puppet accounts too, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, and the thing is, Magic, now here's the weird thing. Magic is up there saying like, yeah, I love everybody at the Lakers. I'm not mad. I don't have any beef. My mind just doesn't, I'm not petty. My mind doesn't operate that way. But you should know that Jeannie Buss, owner of the Lakers, is completely in over her head. She's being pulled in a million different directions by everybody around her, her family, other executives of the Lakers. And the Lakers general manager, Rob Pelinka, is a complete snake and was talking shit about me in the, you know, constantly and blocking what I wanted to do and was backstabbing me. And but I'm not angry. I love everybody. I wish them all the best. And everyone should give them support and believe in them. And it was wild because, like, just the weirdest thing is, it was like, what if somebody played the Mark Antony speech in Julius Caesar completely sincere? Mm-hmm. It was like, no, Brutus is an honorable man. I love Brutus.
I love that guy.
Yeah. And, like, you're like... Damn, like he does, man. Brutus, he's so big of him. He just loves Brutus. Why is everyone rioting?
So he doesn't have people, is my read, right? Magic is just deciding for himself when and where he goes. Because in every other case, in something like this, you have a publicist or an agent or someone who is like, yeah, no, it's just not going to work out that day indefinitely, so you don't get onto a microphone and just burn
get
bridges.
Get on your private jet, go to a beach, and we'll see you in a month.
But he wanted to.
I know.
That's the thing. This isn't like, oh, damn, like Matt, what a misstep from Magic.
Well, when he left, like one of his reasons for leaving was like, I just haven't been able to share my takes on Twitter, and... Like, this is a natural extension of that. It's like, right. Finally.
Yeah. Finally, I get the microphone again. Yeah, yeah.
But it's been fascinating to me to also just watch the way that, like, the convergence of LeBron James, the Lakers, Magic's star power and reputation, all the characters associated with the Lakers, the fact that, like, somehow Phil Jackson and Kobe Bryant are still brought up in connection with this story. It is just fascinating to me the degree to which this is genuinely an interesting sports story. I think what is happening in Los Angeles around the Lakers is genuinely fascinating because it really does seem like a LeBron James has left his home territory in a weird way. And like he is in another country.
Essos.
And yeah, yeah, but you know what I mean? His like, he doesn't have his allies.
Yeah.
Like he has a reputation, but he's not fully in control of what that reputation is.
Well, like he can't fucking get Ty Lue to come help him.
Right. And so this is like, I think there is a fascinating story here about like what happens when you are one of those, like not just a generational, like, you are a type of athlete that appears only once every other generation, right? Like you don't really have peers. What happens when you try one more time to build your name and like build your legend with a group of people who view themselves as the heroes of their own story and think they're on your level? You know what I mean? Like on some level think, what they have going on is as big as you. And it is fascinating the ways in which this is falling apart. And that is a fascinating sports story that's unfolding. It's also kind of an excruciating one if, you know, you're starting to worry that is LeBron's career going to sort of go out with a whimper in this just absolutely dysfunctional organization that seems to almost have buyer's remorse about having him. But the other part of this, though, is this is also under such a microscope because it is just endless content and endless engaging content for everyone who wants to, again, like tap into that audience, right? Like there's a lot of people who follow basketball, but really they only follow a couple teams, a couple players. You know, there's fascinating drama all around sports leagues, but it doesn't get this level of attention because it's not going to move the needle. You're better off showing the highlights. With this team, with this group of people, with LeBron, doesn't matter if the only B-roll you've got is LeBron, you know, sitting courtside on a folding chair, talking to somebody and looking ambivalent. Like, doesn't matter. You run that story because it is still the biggest story in sports.
And I think part of it, or part of the thing that I think makes this interesting to me is when you take that second step and you say, you know, ratings were down this season for the playoffs, despite there being really fantastic playoff games, incredible nail-biting games, even when, you know, you have like a complete sweep like the Golden State Warriors just did, you still end up having these like great last-second moments or performances that are fantastic to watch. The quality of the game, you know, in wrestling terms, the quality of the product is good right now. LeBron does not need to be here for there to be like great games. There are great players across the board still. And, you know, while I think maybe the Bucks-Raptors series has not been what I'd hoped it would be, there have still been great moments, and I'm hopeful for the rest of the series still. It is fascinating to think about, you know, I saw a call the other day that was like, is it time for the NBA to step in with the Lakers and try to like make that organization fix its fucking problems? Because the threat is to the NBA as like a product at large, because at the end of the day, it isn't about good basketball on the court. It isn't about having fun games to watch. It is about, will people tune in? And people aren't just tuning in because the games are good. People are tuning in for the drama. And my question ends up being, like, to tie it back to our old WWE conversation, what if we monetize the rot? Is there a way for the NBA to capitalize on this soap opera shit even more directly that gets people to like tune into the games? Or will this always just be shit that shows up on ESPN? What I'm saying is, give Magic Johnson a microphone, bring him to the arena. Let's let him be a commentator, finally. I just want him in front of a microphone all the time. And I'm curious to see if there is a way, like, is it about more documentary style stuff? Is it about more, like, do you expect in the 2019-2020 season for there to be an emphasis on backroom dealings, a ways in which the NBA can license its product to dig into more of this sort of behind the scenes drama because people seem to care about it? Or are they going to just try to clean it up? Or are they just going to hope that the fucking organization fixes itself?
I think the NBA might like doing something like that, but I think there's a problem, which is that people do not like, for the most part, athletes do not like being labeled as like clubhouse poison,
right?
As troublemakers. And I think this is like one of the things that has made Kyrie Irving really kind of persnickety, is because to a degree, like somewhat justly, Kyrie Irving has been identified as like kind of a fractious teammate. But his response to that is to frequently be like, the fuck do you mean I'm a fractious teammate? Right? Like he's constantly, I don't know what you're talking about. Explain what you mean. And I think Kevin Durant has had a little bit of this as well, where the kind of insecurity and frustration is kind of worn on his sleeve. And I think he's probably, with some reason, concluded that that has probably damaged his value a little bit. Not enough that, like, he is still going to be an incredibly in-demand player. But for guys with that talent level, you're not just saying, like, can I get a great contract? You're asking, can I become like a cultural icon, right? Like, can I keep who I am under wraps enough that, like, to a degree, I can be as popular as Michael Jordan? You know what I mean? Like, Michael Jordan having that friendly public persona despite being, like, kind of a raging asshole.
Right.
You know, if to anyone who actually worked with him. I think there's a lot of incentives for these guys to try to keep that stuff under wraps and don't be so messy in public. And so I think that's going to be the factor that sort of puts the brakes on this a little bit, is in general, it's great content for everybody else. I think for the most part, players tend to be ambivalent about it. I think there's also an element of, it's not reality TV. Like, a lot of people don't get, they don't have that desire to get the spotlight in an episode and do the I'm not here to make friends thing. Like, I think the other part of this, some of these stars, and this is definitely Kevin Durant, is some guys just want to be really good at a game and win and get respect for that. But they don't necessarily want you looking at them all the time outside of that. And I think this is a thing that, like, hits a lot of star athletes, right? It's, you know, you want the fame, you want the championships, you want the popularity. You don't necessarily want the attention. And fame and attention are two different things. And I think, Austin, what you started proposing there is we monetize that attention and we create that NBA attention economy. And it's already humming whether these players want it to or not. But I think leaning into it is really tough for players. I think a lot of people don't want to be LeBron with the decision. And I think it's one of the things that accounts for kind of this weird moment we're at with a lot of free agency, where you got players who kind of want to make power moves but don't want to be seen doing it. And that's my read on this moment.
I think that seems accurate. I as much as I would love some sort of, like, long form, multi-week, you know, docu-style thing, looking at the Lakers back room over the next 12 weeks or so, as, you know, longer, the next 6 months. I also know that, like, if you're anyone on that team, that would be the most disruptive thing possible during a time when all you want to do is figure out how you and your team can best kind of recover after last season.
Yeah.
And it would be unfair to expect that, you know?
Yeah. But nevertheless, it's been good content and has been a much needed shot in the arm to the LeBron James Lakers take economy.
Being in media in 2019, nevertheless, it's been good content.
God, what was that infamous 2016 quote?
Which one? You got to have to get more specific.
I'm scared for my country, but this is good content or something like that. God, I want to say one of the
well,
pundits.
Les Moonves, right? The former head of CVS, I believe, before he was ousted for being a fucking monster, who said, like, yeah, you know, Trump, seems like it's bad for the nation, but damn, like, ratings are up.
Yeah. I think the one that Rob is thinking of is Darren Rovell, who is the which was, I feel bad for our country, but this is tremendous content. Tremendous.
There it is.
Tremendous,
right?
That's, is a
that's
good
not
word.
A political reporter. That's Darren Rovell, whose career sports, intersects is sort of sports, but really it's about, like, do you like money and cheering for it? But hey. Nothing but respect for a reporter who's good on their beat.
He reminds me so much. If you just do a search for home movies gambling money, you will find a great 1 minute, 48 second video from an episode of the great cartoon Home Movies about a guy who you just go, you go look it up. The name of the episode is Stowaway. I forget who the actual voice actor is. I think it's a guest. It's a guest star who's playing an investment guru named Tom Wilsonberg, who just is extremely that mood, that vibe. Please go look it up. I promise you, you will not be disappointed.
Austin dropped that in the doc, so Kato can toss it into the post.
Uh-huh. Yeah. We'll do.
All right. That'll do it for this week's Waypoints. Our thanks to Two Mellow for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at twomellowmakes.bandcamp.com. You can keep up all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people find you?
At Patrick Lepic.
Austin.
At Austin_Walker.
You can keep up with Kato on Twitter at @A_Kato_appears. That will do it for this week's Waypoints. We hope you've enjoyed the break. Please be sure to rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice, if it allows such a thing. I like to think we're a 5-star podcast, but it's not for me to say. That's for you. Give us those 5 stars of your own free will. Otherwise, I don't want them. We'll be back again with Waypoint Radio on Friday, but until then, do not give in to astonishment.
Which he says, as I talk slowly and try and scroll back.
Rob is giving you, like, death eyes.
Oh, stop it, Rob.
We have a Kato. Cut it.
We have a Kato.
We got a Kato.
Sorry, I'm just like, oh, shit, Genie Bus is starting to talk now, too. All right. All right, on the minute. Cool.
All right.
Give me a second to check my. Yeah, Windows bumped up my mic.
Loves to do it.
You hate
to see it.
There it is.
All right, it's fixed. We're good.
I'm watching my waveforms as, like, the wind picks up outside, and I'm like, that's not great.
Turn it down a little.
The wind?
Turn down the wind.
Hold on. I need to. We're going to have to clap in again. I need to hear what the hell I'm picking up.
Okay.
Because, like, the waveform now, like, looks worrying.
Yeah.
That's just wind. That's just wind. All right. I'm going to turn it down. That's as good as we're going to get today, I think. All right, cool. Back to time.is on 25.
Yeah.
Nice.
Wow, you would sound did you like get it? Would you pull it up at like 24? I like it.
I got it.
Good.
I
that
got
was
it.
Good. That
I got
was yep. That was harrowing. That was some Indiana Jones. all right, cool.
Just turn that off.
Oh, hello.
Sorry. Sorry. I'm going to be quiet. Bye.
What was it? I am just curious. Like, what was it?
I just said, okay, going to turn that off, and I turned my camera off as you're trying to do the intro.
Great. Good.
Okay, bye.
All right. So we don't want the camera?
We don't need it because no one's there.
Yeah, Kyle's gone.
Wait, where are you?
I'm at home because of the dentist. Oh, okay. That didn't happen.
Oh,
I didn't
right.
go in after. Okay. I was like, I'll just work.
Yeah, so. Yeah, right. All right, cool.
Third time's the charm.
Here we go.